You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we are talking all things romance in books. I speak to Joseph Murray about his new novel, Fling, a laugh-out-loud Irish romantic comedy which follows a couple who both turn to a dating app when they face problems in their relationship. I talk to Julia Boggio about Shooters, her romantic comedy set in the world of wedding photography. To Charlotte Rickson about the lost love that consumes her new novel, The One That Got Away. And I talked to Sarah Jafari about getting a second chance at love in her new novel, People Change. Our book club book this month is Jessica George's Mame. Jess will join me later in the show to shine a light on her highly anticipated book. We also hear from Afrori Books' founder Carolyn Bain to talk about their campaign to keep Afrori open. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast and you can listen to it wherever you get yours. Please rate, review and subscribe. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and if you have an idea for the show, email it to us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. Having an affair doesn't always mean being unfaithful, or does it? Is the central question in Joseph Murray's debut novel, Fling, which is out this month with Macmillan. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Joseph, and congratulations on this really exciting book.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna. This is actually my first podcast about the book, so I'm very excited to be here with you.
Hopefully we're setting the bar high.
Absolutely, definitely.
So tell us about Fling.
So Fling is an Irish romantic comedy about Tara and Colin. And basically the book starts off with them being in a little bit of a rut. You know, they've been married for 6 years and they've just gone through 3 failed IVF attempts. So a little bit of a rift opens up between them. So then we basically have a kind of a 6-month time jump, and we kind of start to see that the cracks in the marriage are starting to appear. They're drifting apart more and more as time goes on. And then basically they both hear about this new controversial app called Fling. And Fling is an app to find discreet anonymous affairs online. So neither Tara nor Colin are the cheating type, but they are curious and they have these side character friends who encourage them. They're kind of little devils on their shoulder. And they just basically join just to see what's out there and to try to find this kind of, see if, you know, try to feel alive again is a big theme of the book. And what happens is they both find a 100% match on this app called Fling. And bear in mind, it's all anonymous and there's no face pictures or anything like that. So what happens is Tara basically matches with this mystery man called Jack, and Colin starts to fall for this mysterious woman called Claire. So I don't really necessarily want to spoil anything, but like you said, having an affair doesn't always mean being unfaithful. And what Tara and Colin are searching for might be closer than they think. So that probably spoils that a little bit, but if you like the Pina Colada song, you might like Fling. That's all I'm going to say. I've been told I can't give away too much details.
That was actually my next question was it the Rupert Holmes Pina Colada song that inspired you?
So it's funny, actually. I've like heard that song. Obviously, like, everyone is familiar with that song, but I never like necessarily knew the specifics of the lyrics. Mm. And I actually came up with this idea in 2014. It was just walking on my way to a lecture in Trinity College, and I just had this. I heard this idea. I heard about this website that basically it was a real website where people could find affairs online. And I thought to myself, oh my God, imagine if a husband and a wife both went online and joined, and imagine if they started talking to each other. And it was just this kind of funny little idea I had. And I was, you know, studying film at the time, so my mind was always kind of buzzing with all these film ideas, and, you know, so. What happened was then I kind of just put the idea to the side, and I was like, oh, you know, it's just a funny little idea. But it wouldn't leave me alone for years, the idea. Like, it just kept creeping back in. And then one, I was telling someone about the idea once, and they're like, oh, it's like the Pinnacle. And I was like, what? Like, because I know the song. And I was like, but then I went up Google lyrics, and I was like, I looked at it, and I when you read the lyrical story a little bit better, and I was like, oh my God, I was like, it is quite like that. So that kind of actually became an influence, even though it didn't start out as one, if you know what I mean. So I tried to capture that, you know, the fun element of that song. I tried to capture that vibe and put it in the book. So it didn't necessarily give me the idea, but it definitely inspired the idea as time went on, definitely.
Can you read us some of Fling, please, Joseph?
An extract, yes.
I mean, I'd love you to read me the whole book, but only an
hour. I know we probably have a time limit, so I will read basically chapter one, the first, just like the intro pages. So this, it starts off on a little bit of a sad note, even though it is a romantic comedy overall, but it just basically sets the scene for Tara and Colin, how their marriage, how the rift opens up in their marriage. So without further ado, this is my first time ever reading it for anyone. So here we go. So chapter one. "Let's go home," said Tara, feeling as if her life had just ended. To her right, her husband Colin sat rigidly, trying to process the devastating news. Behind his desk, Dr. White was explaining that the embryo transfer had not been successful and that their third attempt at IVF had failed. Time seemed to stand still for Tara in that moment. All she could hear was a strange ringing in her ears, as if a bomb had just been detonated. She couldn't take in what Dr. White was saying. All she could hear was the piercing hum of defeat. But Tara didn't need to listen in order to know what was being said. She knew the spiel off by heart at this stage. She had known as soon as she saw the same tired, apologetic expression on Dr. White's face that her dream of motherhood would remain just that, a dream. "Go home," Colin said, turning to her. "We literally just got here." "I know you must be disappointed, Tara, but rest assured there is still hope," Dr. White said unconvincingly, as if reading from a teleprompter. "I'm sorry, doctor, but I just can't do this anymore," Tara said, picking up her handbag. "I don't mean to be rude, but I really just want to go home." "Tara, we need to know what our options are," Colin said, visibly frustrated by Tara's eagerness to leave. "Colin, we know how this goes. This is the part where we start everything again from scratch, back to square one. Well, many couples don't have a successful IVF treatment until their fourth or sometimes fifth try. In fact, we had one couple who weren't successful until their eighth round," Dr. White explained. Tara winced at the thought. She couldn't bear the idea of going through the entire ordeal once more, let alone multiple times. She had retained a glimmer of hope after the first and second attempts failed, but there was only so much disappointment she could take. Colin had kept telling her that the third time would be the charm. He had almost convinced her of it. Yet here she was, reliving the worst experience of her life for the third time in a row. "Doctor, I think it's time we accepted that I'm not meant to be a mother," Tara said, her heart heavy with an all too familiar despair. "Tara, stop that kind of talk," Colin said. "Oh, come on, Colin. I'm almost 37. My eggs are basically tumbleweeds at this point." Dr. White almost laughed, but Colin shot him a look of disapproval. "Tara, it's only our third attempt. Come on, the fourth time's the charm. You say that about every attempt, Colin. In a few years, you'd be saying 15th time lucky. We've spent 30 grand on this already. We need to stop throwing good money after bad," Tara said, still eyeing the door to leave. She felt smothered. "Well, maybe they have a loyalty card program or something," Colin said, giving Dr. White a hopeful glance. "Oh yeah, Colin, we'll just get a stamp on our way out and our next one will be free. We're talking about my eggs, not a cup of coffee," Tara said, rolling her eyes. "They don't care about our loyalty anyway. They sold us all those stupid add-ons that made absolutely no difference." "Well, you did opt for the premium package," Dr. White explained. "Yeah, and what do we have to show for it? I mean, after at 10 grand a pop, you could have at least thrown in a feckin' tote bag or a top that said, 'I tried IVF and all I got with this was this lousy t-shirt,'" Tara said, frustrated. Tara, this is serious," Colin said, mortified. Tara knew she was being slightly ridiculous, but she also knew if she didn't laugh, she would cry. And Tara was done crying. She had been through this rigmarole enough times to see how farcical it all was. She had every right to make jokes because that's exactly what the whole ordeal felt like. One big joke. "I completely understand your frustration, Tara," Dr. White said, "but you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs." "Well, I'm sorry, doctor, but I ordered my eggs fertilized, not scrambled," Tara said, standing up. "Now I'm sorry, but I really just want to go home." Tara turned and walked out of the room, her mind fully made up. Colin sighed and sluggishly got up off the chair. "I'm sure she'll come around eventually," Dr. White said to Colin. "You clearly don't know my wife," Colin said as he followed her to the car. So that is the little intro of Fling, the first three pages. And so I hope that has maybe whetted some people's appetites for the story. And where it goes from there, basically, is that's kind of the moment that the rift appears in the marriage. And from there, the story kind of begins.
It's such a strong opening, and you managed to make something really quite devastating really funny, which I think can be said throughout the whole book. I very rarely laugh out loud when reading, but I really did when I read Fling, so thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I've heard that quite a bit, actually, that a lot of people said that it's the same kind of rom-com humor that you would mostly see in romantic comedy movies, that more so necessarily than books. And I think that's maybe my film background coming into it a little bit. I like to have that the dialogue as snappy as possible, you know.
Absolutely, that really, really comes across. So, I have a question for you, Joseph, seeing as we're talking a lot about love on this episode of the Brighton Book Club. Are you a romantic?
I am a hopeless romantic, I would say, but I tend to deny that when I'm asked in public. But I will tell you as a little secret. But I would say in general, people need to be more romantic in general, because the way I see romance, well, from a writing point of view, I would say I'm a romantic in the traditional sense, which for me, romanticism is kind of about presenting a world not necessarily as it is, but how it may be as it should be. So my writing is quite idealistic, and I do try to, my themes are kind of very hopeful, and my goal ultimately when I'm writing is to uplift people. So I think there's a lot of a big romanticism influence there. And in my day-to-day life, I am a romantic as well. Now the reason I say hopeless romantic is because I am single, but I haven't been overly lucky in the love world. But at the same time, with the romanticism influence coming in, I'm always very hopeful and always very much, seeing the best of situations and seeing the best of what's to come.
That's a lovely way to put it. So you are one of those annoying people who wrote a book in lockdown. Are you struggling to write now that we're not in that same environment?
Actually, no, but and it's funny we should have this podcast today, because today, January 16th, is the deadline for book number two. So I'll be submitting that in a few hours. It's actually done, so there's no more extra work to be done on it. But to be fair, I actually also wrote the second rom-com in lockdown as well, one of the second lockdowns. So I actually haven't written a book outside of the pandemic. So we'll see what happens. I plan on writing another one this year. So we'll see if that writer's block appears. I'm hoping it doesn't. Because with the pandemic and with the lockdowns, I had to move back to my family home in the countryside. So I was working in Dublin, and I had a job in marketing, quite a good job, and I had a lovely apartment. But the pandemic hit, and I basically lost my job, and I had to move back home because I couldn't afford the apartment anymore. So that was where the kind of the time came to write Fling, because I was like, okay, well, what else am I going to do, I suppose. And then what happened was I got that done, but then of course COVID went on for so long, and I ended up getting a second book done, and that is going to be submitted today. I can't really say much about it at the moment, because it's in the or it's has to go through a lot of editing processes and stuff. But to answer your question, I have not had any writer's block yet, and I've been the words have been flowing. And I'm just going to keep going until they stop flowing, I suppose.
That seems like a very good plan. So, Joseph, how can we find and follow you, especially on TikTok? I hear, although I'm not on it, that you are a big hitter over on TikTok.
Yeah, the TikTok kind of blew up over lockdown as well. That was another thing, because bear in mind, I moved home, I had nothing to do, and I was like, you know what, I'll have a stab at it. And because people were on their phones nonstop, I got quite a lot of views and quite a lot of likes. So my handle on most social media is at Joseph Murray Writes. So I updated it, to have more of a kind of an author handle there recently. So Joseph Murray Writes is on TikTok and on Instagram, and then I think on Twitter it's a J Murray Writes or something like that. But yeah, so there's actually, it's funny, there's a few jokes from my TikTok that ended up in Fling. So you might actually, so readers might kind of have a bit of deja vu, be like, I've heard this before. So I put some of any joke that I put up that went viral. I was like, okay, people obviously find this funny. So I ended up putting it in the book, kind of plagiarizing myself, I suppose, in a way. But I was like, you know what, why not? If the views and the likes were there, it might work in the book as well.
That's so clever. You are so clever. I'm in awe of you. Well, congratulations, Joseph, on completing your first podcast interview.
Thank you so much. I had a great time. I'm really, really thrilled. It's all kicking off now. It's coming out on February 1st. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the background. Kind of the hype is kind of growing more and more. And yeah, I was really, really enjoyed chatting to you, Anna. And thank you so much for having me. And anyone who's interested in pre-ordering the book before February 1st, it's available on most retailers' websites to pre-order. Or if you want to just get it in person, it'll be on all shelves on February 1st. Or sorry, February 2nd. The launch is on February 1st and the book will be on shelves February 2nd.
Julia Brogio is the author of Shooters, a new romantic comedy set in the exciting world of photography. Julia, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us about Shooters?
Sure. So what Julie Cooper's Riders does for show jumping, Shooters does for wedding photography. Stella Price is a newbie wedding photographer after leaving her previous career due to some bad personal choices. And she has limited funds to support herself, so she has to make a success of her new life ASAP or risk moving back to Wales to live with her parents. But the one man who could teach her everything she needs to know is the one man she should stay away from, lest she repeat past mistakes.
That is an excellent pitch.
Thank you very much.
Why, Julia, did you decide to use photography and photographers at the center of this book?
So I used to be a wedding photographer and a portrait photographer. So I started shooting weddings in 2005. And then I opened up a portrait studio in, 2009. It was a world I knew really well. And it's a world that is ripe for drama. I mean, weddings is the perfect dramatic landscape for a book, especially for a romantic comedy. And I felt like wedding photographers hadn't been really done in this way yet. So that's why I went for it.
You must have seen all sorts of things as a wedding photographer.
Yeah, I've pretty much seen it all.
So you cited Julie Cooper as inspiration. Who else and what inspired Shooters?
Oh, God, who else? Well, funnily enough, I mean, some of my friends in the wedding photography industry inspired me. So the main character in my book, Connor Knight, he's inspired by a real life wedding photographer named Jerry Guionis, who's, you know, one of the best wedding photographers in the world. So and I interviewed Jerry for the book as well. But yeah, I think that was probably one of my biggest inspirations. So mostly it was the people I knew and the experience I'd had. That was my biggest inspiration.
Can you read us some?
I sure can. Let me. So this is a bit when they first meet, and Stella is desperate to go onto Connor's course, but it's full. And so she decides to try to convince him to let her on anyway. She sensed her chances sliding away. Desperate times. "I challenge you to a duel," she blurted out, pushing away from the bar and facing him square on. "A duel? What, like pistols at dawn?" "No. Well, yes, sort of. If I win, you let me come on the course. If you win, then I'll find someone else who can help me. Magnus Fiennes has already offered." "Has he now?" Connor paused for a moment. "I'm not saying yes, but what did you have in mind? I'm intrigued." "Thumb wars. Sorry?" She leaned in as though telling him a secret. "It's sort of my superpower." Connor cocked an eyebrow. "So you want a thumb war right now, here, right now, with me?" "Why not?" She gave her head a shake, like a lion fluffing its mane. "Are you scared?" God knew she was. She had held her hands in her pockets to hide the tremor. The stakes had never been higher. It added a frisson of danger, making her stomach feel funny. Or maybe it was standing too close to this man. She remembered what that woman said before his talk. It should be illegal for anyone to be so hot. Stella had to agree. Maintaining eye contact with him felt like trying to force North magnets together. "Of course, I'm just trying to spare you the embarrassment of losing," he said it with surety, with arrogance, with the conviction of someone used to winning at thumb wars. "Okay, I'm in." He held out his hand, steady, ready. She slid her eyes at him. Was he psyching her out, attacking her confidence by having more confidence? She shook her head to dispel the worms of doubt. Instead, like an elite athlete, she visualized the pleasure of beating him, stapling that shadowy projection of euphoria into her brain. I'll leave it there. That scene goes on, but yeah, it's a fun scene where they first meet.
It's a really fun scene, and you really tap into so many of the things that we all love about romantic comedies. So talking about writing romantic comedies, you are the original YouTube star of the wedding dance, which I think is deeply romantic. Can you talk a bit about this and how you managed to slip this into the book?
Well, so back when my husband and I got married in 2005, we decided to have a movie-themed wedding. And so we did the dance from Dirty Dancing as our first dance. It was around the time when YouTube started getting big. And so a couple years after we got married, we put it up online. And within days, we had, like, the Metro was calling us and Richard and Judy and all kinds of, and it was crazy. And it went on for a bit. And then finally, we got a phone call from Oprah Winfrey, who invited us over to America to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And, they said, oh, you just need to just learn half of the dance again. It's fine. So we go on. We're like, well, why does she want us to do half of the dance? It's the end of the dance. That's the best bit. You know? So we go on, we start doing the dance. And then suddenly the crowd is like clapping along politely because we are not amazing dancers. Let me make that clear. And suddenly I just look over my husband's shoulder and the crowd starts going wild and Patrick Swayze is walking towards me.
Oh my gosh.
So then he comes, he's like, can I cut in? And I could not push my husband out of the way fast enough. So, but yeah, that was a good day.
And how did you manage to get the kind of wedding dance flash mob thing into Shooters?
Well, there's a very interesting wedding that happens in the middle of the book, and the couple sort of does something. It's a little bit risque, and it definitely helps the career of the main lady Stella when it gets out into the press. So I had to have a wedding dance in there somewhere.
You really, really did. So are you a lover of all things romance, Julia? Are you a romantic?
I am. I cry at like Hallmark movies and sad commercials. And like my son has this series of books that give biographies on, you know, famous inventors from the past and whatnot. And they're written in such a way that the ends always have this kind of like emotional, like, you know, wrap up of all that they achieved in their life. And I'm always crying. And my son's looking at me like, what is wrong with you? I'm like, this is so romantic and sad. So, but yeah, I've loved romance since I was, you know, since I started reading.
You have your own book podcast called Two Lit Chicks, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us more about that?
So I started it last June. The idea behind it is that it's like Desert Island Discs, but for books. And we speak with well-known writers. In fact, we just launched our episode this morning with Damien Barr, he is such a lovely man. And he actually lives in Brighton as well. So, so that was a really wonderful chat. But yeah, we talked to them about the books that changed their lives. And personally, I feel like I've done an MA in literature because we read all the books that they choose. And then we read books, the book that they wrote as well. So it's a lot of research, but it's great. And I did not, you know, think that I would love podcasting so much, but I really do. It's fun.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, I can attest to that. So just before we go, Home by Midnight is a publishing house that you set up and have published Shooters under. I'd love if you could speak a bit to your experience of doing that and why you decided to take an alternative route.
So, I mean, I don't think it's that alternative anymore. I think that, you know, there are so many people self-publishing out there. I've even become an ambassador for the Alliance of Independent Authors. I'm so passionate about it now. But I had an interesting experience. So I got an agent and she sent out my book to all the publishing houses and we had amazing feedback. And they all said that they loved it, but that they weren't going to take it. And one reason was, oh, we already have a wedding book on our list. The other one that I was told is that they were looking for younger writers in the rom-com space who they thought would have a better chance of going viral on TikTok.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, I'm 48 years old. I'm not exactly, you know, I'm not not almost 100 or anything, but actually 100 year older people are doing really well on TikTok. But yeah, so I decided I just didn't want to wait around anymore. I didn't want to keep going to publishers and whatnot, because, you know, it takes so long once your book gets accepted. I would have been 50 by the time it went out. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it myself. And so I've self-published the book, and you know, I've had really great feedback so far. I mean, Millie Johnson gave me a pull quote. She called it a sexy, sassy, romantic riot. Frances Quinn, Nikki May, who wrote Wahala, is giving me a quote. So, you know, it's it's been an interesting journey, and I've already come up against the snobbery that there is against self-publishing. I mean, I had one podcast host say she wouldn't have me on because I wasn't traditionally published. Mm. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine if that's her thing. Just don't tell me that. You just say your schedule's full, you know. But yeah, no, it's interesting, because the marketing is the hard bit. You know, I wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning to write for 2 hours, because my days are 100% marketing and just reaching out to bookstagrammers and, you know, all kinds of things. And so yeah, but it's very rewarding as well. So
Julia, how can we find and follow you and grab our hands on a copy of Shooters?
Well, it's available on Amazon. It comes out on March 6th in paperback and March 14th in digital form. And and you can find me. It's pretty easy. All of my handles are pretty much at Julia Boggio on Twitter and Instagram, and on TikTok, which I am giving a go. It's Julia Boggio Writer. And my website is juliaboggio.com.
There is a quote at the beginning of Charlotte Rickson's new book, The One That Got Away, that says, "This is for everyone who looked back and wondered what if." And this is the central question at the centre of Charlotte's new book. And I'm really delighted to be joined by her to tell us more about it. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
The One That Got Away. Tell us about this lovely novel.
So this is really cliche to say, but during lockdown, I went slightly insane, and I also turned 40. And I think I had a bit, well, in my house, this book is called My Midlife Crisis Novel. But yeah, basically, I write thrillers and psychological suspense in my kind of other life. And I just wanted to write something for me. So it was just a book that I think when you turn 40, you start looking back and thinking about your former life choices and things that have happened to you. And yeah, I just had this huge wave of nostalgia for like my early 20s, really. And I sort of wanted to write about that time, because it's just such a, you know, you're an adult, but really you're not an adult. So yeah, I kind of wanted to think about like first love and how it all impacts the rest of your life. There are just all these big themes coming up. And so I just thought, I'm going to write this book just for me, because it's something completely different from my other novels. And yeah, I sat down, I had a bit of time in the summer, and I wrote it in like 6 weeks. And I genuinely, I know people say this all the time, but I had no intention of getting it published. It wasn't something I wrote with that in mind. But then I sent it to my agent anyway. And she was like, "I love it. It doesn't need any edits." And she sent it out, and then it sold in like a week. So it's a very weird story. But I'm still kind of in shock, I think, that it's being published.
It's like a whirlwind romance.
Yes, yes. It was like, it was just weird. It was like, I don't know, I got out all this stuff that I'd clearly been thinking and mulling over in that year where we were all sort of stuck at home. So yeah, it was very cathartic to write.
So in the pitch for this book, it says this is a story of first love and second chances. Is this based on your own first love? Were you sitting there thinking, "Oh, that was the one that got away"?
Yes, to some extent. I think the thing is, I've always been fascinated by first love. I just feel like if you're lucky, you have this kind of great first romance, and whether it lasts or not, it's something you're always going to remember, and you know you're always going to look back on and think, you know, that was a very special time in my life. And I think you're so I don't want to say green, but when you first fall in love, you don't have any baggage, so you don't have any kind of like, you just let yourself go with it, you're just like all in. And yeah, I think as you get older, and unfortunately you start to put up a few walls because you've been hurt before by certain things, you're sort of relationships afterwards are slightly different. So yeah, in a way it's slightly based on my first love, that kind of intensity. I remember very well, you know, how I fell in love with my first ever boyfriend, and it was just completely everything and all consuming. And we did break up at the end of university, and that was what was meant to happen. I don't have any regrets about it, but I think it was just looking back on that. And I really wanted to explore a character who'd never got over it, basically, because I think, you know, we all sort of, I mean, hopefully we all move on and we mature and we have new relationships. But I was kind of fascinated by the thought of somebody who just hadn't managed to move past that at all. So that was sort of where it came from. And then there's loads of other stuff in it too.
There's a gorgeous sense of early noughties nostalgia in this book, yes, which I absolutely loved. Can you speak a bit to the kind of idea of dating and falling in love then and now?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think, yeah, well, obviously mobile phones, were, I did have a mobile phone, but, you know, we could only text. So there was no photos being sent and things like that. And obviously, I think most people met people in person. So in a bar, I met my first boyfriend at university. I met him in a nightclub. And that's how Clara meets Benjamin in the book too. So I guess it's a very different, I mean, to be honest, I feel so out of touch with, like, I don't know how people have romances these days. I feel so old. And that's another thing. When you get to 40, you're like, oh, wow, I'm really fascinated by 20-year-olds. I need to hang out with some and find out what kind of makes them tick, because it's just so different from my experience. And I do have a daughter, but she's only 7. So I've got a way off. So I feel like I'm missing out a big chunk of that, like, teenage and early kind of 20s experience. I need to make some friends in that arena. But I think, I mean, at the end of the day, love is love. So I guess those feelings don't change, and there's a lot of hormones involved, and I'm thinking those things don't change either. So I hope all ages will relate to the book, but I guess it probably will be slightly more relatable to older readers who can also identify with that period, which was, yeah, it was a very different time. I do feel like girls, I mean, I'm not going to get into a whole feminist rant about what we behave like, but yeah. It was very different in the sense of, I think a lot of girls were not quite as empowered as they are today, which is a good thing.
Absolutely. So can we hear some from this book and tell us tell us where we find our characters?
Okay, so this is the opening, because it's quite a complicated book, and I thought if I start reading from the middle or somewhere like partway through, it's not going to make a lot of sense. So this is the prologue, and it's kind of from an unidentified narrator's point of view. So I will try and read it now. So it starts with April 2022, 4:57 p.m. It's a hotter day than anyone anticipated for April, and he's sweating, but not just because of the heat. The backpack, so carefully laden with its components just a few hours ago, is sticky against his back. He's wary of the crowds jostling him as he strides towards the stadium. He has been here so many times before, he knows the place as intimately as he knows his own home. Today, he has feigned illness, and for the first time in years, missed the game. They are spilling out now, a swarm of ants in red and white striped vests, buoyed by their unexpected win, 3-2 at home to a worthy opponent. Collective euphoria electrifies the air. It's a sickness, an epidemic, and soon they'll be cured of it. His face burns red with the effort, the weight of the bag, the internal countdown in his mind. Not too much longer. Seconds, literally seconds, before it will all end. His heart is hammering. He realises he has been holding his breath. A hand flies to his forehead as if to steady himself. And the sea of people, mostly men, mostly 3 pints or more down, coming towards him, those red and white worker bees, starts to blur and merge. Homogeneous people, almost indistinguishable from one another. 52,000 of them. It's impossible to see them as anything but one mass, a moving entity. Nothing individual about them at all. Collateral damage. But then one stands out to him, a girl no more than 6, held high on her father's shoulders, waving a scarf, hair in bunches, grinning from ear to ear. It's almost too much. He sucks air into his lungs, turns away, head down, keeps walking, bigger strides to put distance between himself and the girl. He mustn't think of them as individuals. The stadium is just a few feet away now, security on the doors, making sure everyone gets out safely. This is the side where the VIPs go after the game. He knows he'll be in there, celebrating. He has planned it all so carefully. His fingers fumble for the detonator. He says a short prayer to no one in particular that he has got it right. And then a second's pause. He looks down at his free hand, turning it over and marvelling at his skin, the lines across his palm, the blue-green of his veins. Someone bumps against his shoulder as they pass. He He is at the entrance now, as close as it's possible to get. It's time. In the end, it's no more difficult than letting go of the string of a balloon. He presses the button, and then he is gone.
So this is such a powerful opening, but it doesn't strike me as a kind of romance. And when you hear that opening to the book, it's really kind of stands in quite stark contrast to the title, you know, The One That Got Away. There's this devastating central event that kind of kicks off the book, as we've just heard. Yes. What compelled you to kind of mix these two things?
Well, it's so interesting because it has been slightly marketed as a romance, but when I wrote it, it definitely wasn't in my mind a romance. I as I said, I really wanted to write about first love because I just think, you know, it does have an impact on your future relationships. And that was the thing I really wanted to examine. So it was kind of, if your first love ends in this terrible way, how do you get over it? And how does that impact your future? So yeah, I saw it more like a book club. I mean, I know genre with books is you know, it's like a whole minefield, to be honest. So obviously it has a romantic element in it, but I remember when I got the offers from my publishers and they were saying, oh, it's so romantic. And I was like, oh, is it? I don't see it as romantic, but I guess it does have a love story in it. But to me, it's not a love story. It's about first love. So I'm interested in those themes, but obviously I am a suspense writer. So to me, you know, I do like a bit of darkness, and yeah, it does have quite a lot of dark themes in. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, books are books. So I hope people who enjoy a good story will enjoy it. It's not going to follow the same kind of formula as a conventional romance. So I will say that if you're looking for a kind of lighthearted read, it's definitely not the one.
But there's something kind of really real and raw about this book.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I did want it to be realistic. I think I love escapism. I love a bit of fantasy, you know, just like kind of losing yourself in this lovely, lovely, immersive, glorious read. But for me, I'm really interested in people and character. So the two characters, they're so young when they meet and they make so many mistakes. They really mess up, but they do have reasons for being the way they are. They've both had difficulties in their childhoods and stuff. So I'm just more interested in complex characters. So yeah, they're definitely flawed, but I hope they learn as they can grow throughout the novel, because it spans 20 years. So it's quite a big kind of time frame.
Charlotte, how can people find and follow you and stay up to date with news about this book?
So I am everywhere. I'm a bit overexposed. No, I'm on Twitter as Char Duck. So my real name is Charlotte Duckworth, and that's my other name that I write under. So I think Instagram is the same, Char Duck, at Char Duck. And then I'm not on TikTok. See, I probably should join TikTok and then I'd know more about dating in your 20s. And I also have a website, which is charlotterickson.com.
The One That Got Away is out on the 2nd of February with Head of Zeus. Can things be different the second time around is the question that Sara Jafari asks in her new book, People Change. This is a really great romantic book about a couple that find each other years after they first were together. Sara Jafari, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Can you introduce yourself and talk about People Change?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Sara Jafari. My debut novel, The Mismatch, came out in 2021, and People Change is my second novel, which is coming out in February. I worked previously as an editor at Penguin Random House, and now I'm a freelance editor and focusing on my writing a bit more. People Change is a novel about two British Iranian people, and it kind of goes back and forward. So you see them 10 years ago when they were at school, the characters Shirin and Kian, and then you see them 10 years later when they see each other for the first time in 10 years. And there's kind of like something hanging between them, and you kind of don't know what that is at the start of the book, and it kind of uncovers that they've kind of got a past and kind of a secret that'll be uncovered. And it's a book about, I guess, whether people change or whether kind of relationships can work second time around. But also I think it's really a book about kind of overcoming kind of past trauma and finding yourself, really. So I think, yeah, it's a definitely a love story, but it also has kind of other things in it as well. Shirin works in publishing, and in it, in the publishing house that she works in, it's quite toxic, and she kind of deals with a lot of microaggressions, and it kind of reminds her of her like childhood at school. And it's all about her kind of working out whether she can stand up for herself and how she'll do that.
Can you read us them?
Yes, sure. So I'm going to read from the second chapter. So the chapter heading is Someone I Used to Know. Shirin, Kian says, lips parted, his eyes squinting slightly, like he is wondering whether he is mistaken, whether it is really her. Shirin is also taken aback by the image of him before her. In her mind, he is always 16, baby-faced but beautiful. His face has developed a sharpness to it that it didn't have back then, his drawn cheekbones strong and well-defined. It is the strangest sensation to see someone you once knew very well as a teenager standing before you, matured, as though out of nowhere. Hi, she says eventually. She has imagined this moment many times before, and she always says something much grander than hi. You know each other? Millie asks, looking from one to the other. Yeah, we went to school together, Kian says, back in Hull. Seeing Kian again after all these years makes Shirin regret coming here. Her gut, she knows, is usually right about these things, and she should have listened to it. Being so close to him now brings memories to the surface, up out of her belly, almost spilling out of her throat. Even him saying we makes her heart thud wildly and pathetically. Oh, small world, I guess, Millie says, uninterested by this moment that is so monumental to Shirin. She tucks a blonde strand of her hair behind her ear before continuing to say, well, I'm sure you have lots to chat about. And Millie is gone, returning to Henry, and Shirin is left reeling, thinking, please, for the love of God, don't leave me alone with this person I used to know. Well, hello, Kian says, beaming. It is an uncomplicated smile, the kind of smile Shirin cannot imagine having. She struggles to smile on cue, her face a permanent frown that she often tries and fails to soften. Like now, the tops of her lips are raised upwards, but the rest of her face is unmoved. The smile does not touch her eyes because, when she looks at Kian, she does not see just a person she cared so deeply for. She sees all of the shit from her childhood that she has worked so hard to leave behind. Long time no see, she says, her voice cooler than she feels. What are you doing here? I came with Millie. I didn't know you lived here. She scratches her neck to have something to do with her hands and to mask that they are shaking. Kian tells her that he sometimes hangs out with Henry because Henry is Dylan's hometown friend and that Dylan went to university with Kian. It is a too coincidental and too long-winded connection. What are the chances, she cannot help but think, that these two people from Hull have found themselves in a connecting friendship 10 years later? Isn't that the whole point of moving away from your hometown, so that things like this don't happen?
Thank you so much. So People Change is all about second chances. What was it that inspired you to write about this?
Yeah, I think I was inspired by some of like my favorite books are kind of second chance kind of love stories. So I really loved One Day by David Nicholl. I guess that is, yeah, essentially many second chances in which kind of, yeah, there's two characters and they kind of keep coming back to each other. And I also am a big fan of like Normal People as well, which is kind of a similar kind of vibe of second chances. And I kind of really like, in terms of like in love stories, the idea of kind of two people who've known each other quite a while kind of coming back together like as adults and kind of having changed quite a bit and matured and kind of seeing whether they can work again. I think that's quite an interesting, kind of an interesting idea, and I kind of really wanted to explore that.
Absolutely. It's really refreshing and important, I think, to read romantic books with diverse characters in them. And the two protagonists in your book are British Iranians. And what's the reaction been to readers that have been, you know, been able to see themselves in a book where they might not have been able to before?
Yeah, so for like The Mismatch, my first book, the reaction was really amazing. I think I received like a lot of messages, like even now, a year and a half later, from people kind of saying they really relate to like the character in my book. And like one person even said that she felt like her life was copied and pasted into the book. So it's really, really nice to see. And I think, you know, the reason obviously there's many reasons why I write Iranian characters, but I guess one of the main reasons why is because when I was like growing up, I didn't really see people like me in books. I think British Iranian and just Iranian in general characters are really underrepresented in literature. So I think, yeah, it was really important to kind of write Iranian characters, and the reaction's been really good. I think, you know, even having just one message with someone saying that it feels like their life is in my story is just like enough, because really that's what we want when we read, to see ourselves.
There's an interesting kind of critique of the publishing industry in this book, and I love
with publishing. You know, I always, it's kind of meta, but also because I work in publishing, I just love to see it. How did you kind of explore the, you know, the tribulations of the publishing industry in this book?
Yeah, so I worked in publishing. So I drew from some of my own kind of experiences or things that I've heard other people have gone through. I think, so kind of for people who haven't read the book yet, in the book, Shirin works in publishing. It's always been like her dream to be like an editor. And currently she's an assistant editor, kind of looking for a promotion as an editor. And yeah, I guess within the publishing industry, there are like microaggressions in which, you know, people kind of say things that kind of make her feel quite uncomfortable. But I guess with microaggressions, they seem so small or like not too big that she kind of can brush them aside, but they do tend to build. And I think that is kind of how it is for kind of a lot of people, especially in publishing. I don't think from my experience, I don't think anyone's particularly awful. Like people don't say like awful things, but there might be small things that happen that can kind of build and kind of chip away at a person. But something that I kind of explored in the book as well was, I guess, the idea of like diversity and inclusion kind of groups within publishing. I think a lot of the time there was the expectation that mainly people of color kind of, they have to kind of lead the diversity and inclusion like initiatives, even though they're not experts in it. And you know, if I'm Iranian, it doesn't mean I know everything about every Asian person. So it kind of, there's a lot of like, yeah, I guess work that people of color have to do in publishing on top of their normal job. And it's kind of not seen that this is kind of a bad thing necessarily, that they're doing extra work and not being paid for it. And that's kind of something that Shirin kind of experiences. Like she might not get a promotion, but she'll have to do extra diversity initiative training for the whole team. That's kind of what I explored in the book a bit.
Are you romantic, Sarah? Do you believe in the power of first love and reconciliation?
I think I am romantic to an extent. I think I really love romance books. I think definitely when I was younger, I definitely was more romantic and kind of believed more in the power of first love. But I think I love writing about it. And I think there is something really special about a first love. It's such a unique feeling that I think I kind of feel like, maybe this is a generalization, but I feel like a lot of us can kind of look back nostalgically on it and kind of, I guess that's why I wrote about a story in which two people come back together and it was their first loves, because it is just a really special kind of feeling and kind of, yeah, I think there's something really nostalgic about it.
What is next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
So I'm working on two different things at the minute. I'm working on, I guess, my third novel, which isn't really a romance novel, but it is kind of similar to my two other books, I guess, kind of thematically. So I'm working on a book about, it's kind of set after 2020, kind of during like the Great Resignation, and a character essentially quits her job as a lawyer and also breaks up with her boyfriend, her long-term boyfriend, and kind of just starts again. She's very burnt out from her job. And that's when she meets a new guy who seems really perfect, but things aren't quite as they seem. So it's got kind of a suspense element to it, and it gets quite dark, but I'm interested in it. And I think I'm particularly interested in, I guess, how the world has changed now. I know some people say they don't want pandemic books, but I do think it's kind of undoubtedly we've all kind of changed, like mentally, since everything. Now that life's back to normal, I don't know, me and my friends, I still see that we are quite changed by it all, and kind of even the way we view work and like social life, it's just all changed quite a lot. And I think a lot of people seem quite drained. So I kind of wanted to explore that in a book as well. I'm quite enjoying it. And the other thing I'm working on is a kind of Persian mythology retelling. It is very like rough at the minute, but I kind of would like to write like a short story collection retelling Persian mythology. So it's the Shahnameh is the name of the kind of collection of stories that's been translated, but there's really not much in the English language for the mythology out there, so I'd kind of like to explore doing that as well.
Sounds amazing. I will be first in line to grab both of those. How can we find and follow you and keep up with your news?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, so it's Sarah Jafari for both of them, and that's where kind of I'll post updates about books or kind of new things that are going on, so you can keep up to date with me there. Some of the books also, People Change, is also going to be out in the US under a different title, and it's going to be it wasn't meant to be like this. And that'll be out next year. And it's actually going to be edited a little differently as well. So if you enjoy people change and want to see what happens in an alternate version, you can.
People Change is out now with Penguin. Our book club book this month is Mame, published by Hodda. Here is the blurb. Meet Maddie. All her life, she's been told who she is. To her Ghanaian parents, she's Mame, the one who takes care of her family, her mum's stand-in, the primary carer for her father who suffers from Parkinson's. She's the responsible sister, the quiet friend, the one who keeps the peace and the secrets. It's time for her to speak up. Maddie knows what kind of woman she wants to be, one who wears a bright yellow suit, dates men who definitely aren't on her mum's list of prospective husbands, and stands up to her boss's microaggressions. Someone who doesn't have to Google all her life choices, who demands a seat at the table. But will it take losing everything to find her voice? Unique, unfiltered, and forgettable, Mame is a deeply moving, achingly funny debut about finally finding where you belong. I was really glad to have read this wonderful novel. I fell in love with Maddie in this book. It's a kind of coming of age in your 20s novel, and I was really rooting for her the whole way. It's also really quite profoundly a book about grief and about friendship and responsibility and of trying to find your way in a world that doesn't always make sense. It also has a great thread in it about the publishing industry, which is always a win for me, because any kind of insider takes on this bizarre industry is always really intriguing. I'm really excited to be joined by the author, Jessica George, to tell us more about this fabulous book. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Jess.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How does it feel to be the author of one of this year's most hotly tipped books? Because they are throwing a lot into this book.
They are. It's overwhelming because it's not what I expected. I've been trying to get published for 8 years, and Mame is the sixth book I've tried to do that with. And I think it's every author's dream to have like a great marketing campaign and to be featured on all these lists. So every time something comes up, it sinks in a little deeper. I don't think it's going to fully sink in until the book is out.
So you said this is the sixth different book that you've tried it with. This is the sixth book you've written. Where are the other five?
They're on, they're on my laptop. They're in my hard drive. They're just languishing there. They were all submitted. They just weren't picked up by any agents or publishers. And recently I've been thinking about whether I'd revisit them. The fifth book I wrote is, I got an agent with, but no publishers wanted the story. So my agent and I are thinking about revisiting that one after my second book is done. But as for the rest, I think I'll leave them to be lessons.
What do you think it was about Mame that really captured the editors?
I really don't know, because I didn't think it was going to be the one to take off. All I hear is that because there are so many topics and themes I touch on, there's something relatable for everyone, for every reader to relate to. And I know people are a fan of the characters, which is great. And kind of the conversational narrative tone of it, I think Maddie's really lovely to talk to, in a sense, to kind of listen to and to follow. So a combination of all of those things.
So Maddie's experience, like I said, of grief really resonated with me in particular. How did you find the process of writing about your beloved dad?
So it was quite cathartic at first. I first started writing this book as diary entries for just me. I didn't intend to make it a book straight away. It was great to have something to do with all the feelings. It's been quite difficult to edit it over and over again. Now that it's out there, almost out there, it's actually such a wonderful thing to have something about my dad in book form. I kind of put this in the acknowledgement. Like, as I get older, the less I remember things, and as more time goes by, the less I can recall certain memories. And so I'm glad I have them now, like forever in paper.
Yes, absolutely. What are you working on next? What's next for you?
So book two I'm attempting to write is just a book about platonic friendship now. It's about making friends in your late 20s after you lost all your friends to career relocation and physical relationships and all of those things. But like, there's a lot of focus on meeting the one. So I kind of focus on meeting the one friendship.
I think that's really lovely. And the friendships in Mame are absolutely gorgeous. Anyone would be so lucky to have friends like the like Maddie's friends in this book. So thank you so much for joining us, and really, really good luck with the publication of the book. How can people find and follow you, Jess, if they want to grab a copy of this?
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram, Jessica B. George. I'm much more active on Instagram, but I am on Twitter as well.
One person who also loved Mame is Caroline. One person who also loved Mame is Carolyn Bain, the founder of Afrori Books in Brighton. She said it took her on a wonderful journey and Mame won her heart. You'll have heard Carolyn on previous episodes of the Brighton Book Club. She is the founder of the unique Brighton bookshop called Afrori, which holds the biggest selection of books by Black authors in the country. She also co-founded the Brighton Book Festival, which took place last year and was absolutely wonderful. Now, Carolyn and Afrori Books need your help. Following a rent hike, they cannot remain in their current location and survive as a shop. So as of the 1st of April, they will leave their Kensington Street location. They desperately need a new space and they need it quickly. They are looking for a commercial shopfront that is a reasonable distance from Brighton Station to accommodate customers from outside of the city, which is about 30% of their customers. Last year, they ran 48 craft mornings, education workshops, hosted over 50 authors. They put on a book festival, as I said, an art exhibition, two blockbuster movies and over 50 book clubs. All of that requires equipment like tables and chairs, crockery and cutlery. The new space will need a shop fit, and that means new bookshelves and decorating. This does not come cheap and they need to raise £25,000. This money raised would ensure that they can cover the moving costs, deposits, shop fitting and any extras needed. They really want to and should be able to continue on their mission to support Black authors, create diverse bookshelves and be a voice against injustice. So every pound you give genuinely makes a difference and will help them continue to be a safe space in the city for marginalised people. Please visit afroribooks.co.uk/product/donate-90 to donate whatever you can and keep this bookshop and their mission going. And thank you so much for listening to the Brighton Book Club. We'll be back next month for a deep dive into our next book club book, If They Knew, the new thriller by Sophie Flynn. What would you hide to get everything you ever wanted? After 2 years of infertility and heartbreak, Hannah and Charlie are finally going to get their dream family. 2-year-old Isabel is a week away from being theirs. They just have to get through the final adoption approval process. But when a global pop star is found murdered at the Celebrity Members Club in their sleepy Oxfordshire village, Hannah fears her past is finally catching up with her. Exposing the truth could see her lose everything. Her husband, Isabel, perhaps even her life. But Hannah doesn't realise that Charlie has his own secrets and, in trying to save her, has put them more at risk than she ever thought possible. As the couple get drawn in further and further into the murky world of celebrity and murder, they soon find themselves caught in a nightmare, forced to make terrible choices. How many bad things will a good person do to hold on to what they love? A twisty, utterly addictive psychological thriller for fans of Adele Parks and Lisa Jewell. You will not be able to put this down. Sophie and I will talk all things writing, publishing, fictionalizing your life, structuring thrillers, and writing communities. You can listen to the Brighton Book Club wherever you get your podcasts and throughout the month on Radio Reverb. Follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and send your pictures and ideas to btmbookclub@gmail.com. We will see you next month. Precious.